Well, let's talk a little bit about Because It Is Bitter and Because It Is My Heart, and talk about you a little bit. I immediately recognized the title from a poem from Stephen Crane.
Yes.
It's been so many years since I've read Crane, but as I recall, it was about a youth who was sitting in a roadway, and a stranger comes up to him and says, "The youth is eating his heart."
I hear
the stranger says, "Why are you eating your heart?" Or do you have the poem?
I typed it out in case you'd like me to read it.
Sure, read it to me. Yes. It's been so many years.
This is a poem by Stephen Crane that he wrote in the 1890s, and I had first read it, I think, when I was in college, and it really stayed with me. It's very stark, minimalist poetry of a kind that nobody else was writing at that time. In the desert. In the desert, I saw a creature, naked, bestial, who, squatting upon the ground, held his heart in his hands and ate of it. I said, "Is it good, friend?" "It is bitter, bitter," he answered, "but I like it because it is bitter and because it is my heart."
What does that poem, I never really understood it. It was something elusive about it. What does that poem mean to you?
It means a number of things. When I first read it, I took it as an allegorical statement about the human condition, that human beings may be bitter and that they may concentrate on memories, on past injustices. But if you examine them very closely, their motives are that they like what they're doing. The bitterness is part of the enjoyment of being human. That's one reading of allegorical nature, I think. I took it also as referring to the writer's subject matter, that writing doesn't have to be about happy, saccharine, very sunny subjects. It can be about bitterness and injustice and anger as well. But I like it because it is bitter and because it is my heart. It just has a lot of resonance for me, I guess, in terms of much of my writing. Many novelists are in love with their material, even though other people think it's somewhat grim. I'm sure that Faulkner was very much in love with his material, though people looked upon him as being decadent and rather bleak.
Well, how do you apply this line? Crane always called his poems lines. I think his most famous book was The Black Rider,
The Black Rider,
as I recall. When I was an adolescent, I loved Crane. He was my favorite poet. But tell me how you apply the title to this wonderful novel of yours.
Well, the novel for me relates back to my early girlhood, when I was growing up in upstate New York, in a city called Lockport, New York, which in the novel I've changed to Hammond and I fictionalized. Lockport, like Hammond in the novel, had an uptown which was all white and a lower town which was black, and it was a kind of geographical segregated American city. Of course, I didn't have any sense of this when I was growing up in that area because I, like all children, I just accepted what was there. I wasn't looking at the city of Lockport as an allegorical representation of America or of segregation in America. But then when I look back upon it as the years went by, I wanted to write a novel about neighborhoods, some of which I was familiar with, in which black and white people met, the two cultures met. And as one moves in extremes along a social scale toward the middle, upper middle class, white society, one moves farther and farther away from this black neighborhood where the two races were meeting. So I look upon it, the bitterness that is Iris Courtney's particular experience of growing up in America, that she really has, she feels she loses her past. She has to reconstruct herself or invent a personality. She leaves the past behind, and she leaves Jinx Fairchild, who is this young black man, for whom she feels very strong affection and deep bond, she leaves him behind. So I think it's a bitterness that's tinged with something like bittersweetness.
But all through the book, until the very end, Iris maintains a love for Jinx. What do you suppose this is? Isn't it true that there are some things best left behind?
Well, she feels a deep bond with him, and he thinks of her as his little white sister. And they just had a mutual experience that neither were ever here with another person. And they just build bond in a very deep way. Sometimes it happens between people who can't even be friends that they met each other. And it often happens in adolescence or childhood. And then people grow up. I'm sure we all have friends whom we remember very vividly and very keenly from when we're 10, 11, 12 years of age, and we're very close to these people, but we've grown thousands of miles apart, and there's a great abyss between us. I'm making it sound very romantic. I think most novelists are romantic, and I have to remember that my novels don't read like romances to other people, even though for me they're very much homages to the past, and they have a memorializing impulse.
You have a tremendous range and interest in the subject. I understand you have a great interest in boxing.
I wrote a book on boxing, a book-length essay on boxing. But if you thought about boxing, you see, that really came to fruition in one sense in the 1950s. And that's an era that I know about. And my father used to take me to Golden Gloves fights in Buffalo, New York. So it's very much a part of that immigrant culture or working class culture. And it's bound up with learning about America and learning about masculine America, I guess one could say. As a little girl, I was not at all critical. I mean, I wasn't thinking like a feminist in those days. I was sort of being initiated into this masculine culture by my father.
Well, I was interviewing Bud Schulberg a while back, who told me that he also has a fascination, and almost an obsession with boxing. One of his best books was The Heart of a Fall.
Oh, yes.
But he says this doesn't seem to be unusual for writers. You can cite other writers, Mailer, for example, also have this strange obsession. Boxing seems to be such a brutal, primitive sport. I just wonder why that would be.
Well, boxing has a long history, and if you're interested in American history, you see the rise of the immigrant, the succession of immigrant boxing champions. Then if you're interested in black history, you have to look at sports, because sports in America is very important to understand black history. And the first black heavyweight title holder was Jack Johnson back around 1909, and he's a kind of paradigm for certain black champions like Muhammad Ali and others who are very charismatic and very defiant. And that goes back to 1909 when black men were really, it was dangerous for them to have that attitude.
Have you ever seen a female boxing match?
No.
I was watching one on television a while back. It's strange. You know, you wonder where they're going to get hit.
Yes. Well, I'm interested in the history of boxing, so I wouldn't be that interested in women boxing because that's always been very marginal. For me, I am, as an American novelist, I guess I could identify myself very interested in the history of America, and my novels tend to often be about recent history. Like this novel takes place in the 1950s, ends about 1964, so I have that distance between now and then.
Yeah, it's strange. When I was growing up, I never thought of the North as segregated. Now, I grew up a portion of my childhood in Houston, Texas, where in the 1940s, where everything was segregated,
yes.
But we accepted that. And strangely, it wasn't until the 1960s, when I was working in a radio station in Pennsylvania, that I discovered there was blatant discrimination against blacks. And this was circa 1964, 63, 64,
yes.
About the time of the Civil Rights Movement.
Yes.
I had no idea. I remember going to the tap room of the largest hotel in town with a young black woman who was a school teacher. And I was teaching a class in folk music or something. She was attending. It was an adult education class. And I walked into the hotel with this woman, and they refused to serve us.
Mm.
Absolutely refused. I caused kind of a scene, because I was
news
director of a local station, and I was chewed out, and it was very embarrassing.
Yeah.
And I was furious. I was absolutely upset because when I left with this girl, she said, just don't worry about it. It's all right. But it wasn't all right.
And you ran into the color bar that you never knew was there.
I never knew it was there, and I was outraged. And I think I only had a glimpse of what they went through.
I know. Isn't it sad? Yes. Well, much of the novel, whether the characters are black or white, is written with a sense of people inhabiting their skins and being defined in terms of their skins. And in some of the scenes, Iris Courtney is aware of black maids coming in the room, you know, carrying food and being servants of white people and really looking at the black women. And most white people in situations like that don't see the black servants at all. They literally don't see a human being come in a room and serving hors d'oeuvres and drinks and so forth. I guess I'm just aware of that. I think part of it was because when I lived through the time that I'm writing about in that novel, I was bussed into Lockport from the country. I was an outsider, and I came into a racially mixed junior high school, and the black children were bussed up from this lower town area, which is the same as in the novel. So I was an outsider, too, and the black kids were outsiders in a way, so I could kind of look at them and observe them. I've always been very interested in people and how they mix in groups. So I was always aware of black people, and like all of us, I projected onto them certain qualities of strength or coolness or otherness. And it isn't really until I was an adult that I would look back and think, well, they were projecting those qualities on white people too. Coolness, coldness, otherness, dislike, intimidation, and so forth. That the races see one another in terms of these qualities that are projected outward.
Well, let's go back to Lockport and tell me about your origins and what kind of life you had, because it's always interesting to talk about that aspect of a writer's life, because it sheds some light on why the writer became what the writer became.
I don't know how to characterize myself. I've never thought much about myself. I tend to be very infatuated or obsessed with places, with settings. The Erie Canal runs through Lockport, New York. Well, I've written about the Erie Canal probably 100 times. I can describe it. I see it very vividly in my mind. And I'm very interested in people and personalities and how they inhabit certain spaces. Naturally, the drama, it's an ongoing drama or tragedy or melodrama, whatever it is, between the races would be very, very interesting for anyone growing up in America. Because it's an inevitable drama. And when I started writing that novel, it didn't seem to me that we were headed for such a time of conflict as we are right now. There seems to be a resurgence of racial discrimination and bigotry. We've been reading about, even on college campuses. Well, when I started writing that novel a few years ago, I didn't anticipate that. So it's almost as if, in spite of civil rights in the 60s and affirmative action and so forth, that not that much has changed, basically, since the time of the novel.
Well, back to you. Did you grow up in a literary household?
No, I didn't. I was the first person in my family to graduate from high school. Both my parents came of age in the Depression, and they had to quit school. Grade school. And so we were quite poor. I mean, everybody was poor. And we were not aware of being poor. It's just all in retrospect now. I was very lucky that I came along when I did, that I wasn't born earlier. I wouldn't have been able to go to college. There wouldn't have been money for that. My father worked for General Motors company.
Were you a big reader?
Oh, yes, I've always loved to read. Yes.
Hung around in the stacks of the library?
Yes, yes. Public libraries exerted a strong fascination for me. I'm a very romantic person, I guess, about books.
Well, you went to Syracuse, didn't you?
I did, yes.
What did you study there?
I studied English and philosophy.
Had you set some goals for yourself as you entered college?
No, I never had a sense of goals. I'm very project-oriented. I work on one project at a time. Or I might have a sense of a trilogy or a quartet of novels. But it tends to be like one project at a time. I've never thought of myself in terms of being a writer. I would be that seems pretentious to me. There's something very abstract about it.
I'm sorry, you don't think of yourself in terms of being a writer?
I never did.
You do now, though.
Well, I think in terms of projects. Like, I'm working on a project at home, a short story, or I have a new project that's a play, or I will start a novel next year. But I never did when I was a young person. I started writing when I was, you know, 5 years old, 5, 6, 7 years old. And at such an early age, one doesn't think of being anything, just what you're doing.
Well, when you were in college, was it your intention to, at some point, teach or what?
Yes, I was going to be a college teacher. In fact, I've taught college for quite a while.
And you still do?
I'm at Princeton.
Creative writing, Princeton?
Yeah, I've always liked teaching. I like working with students, and I like having texts and teaching and taking literature seriously.
And you went on to Wisconsin?
I did, yes. I got my master's degree at Wisconsin.
It's like the frozen north.
Yes, yes.
Well, tell me about your early work, your first published work, and how that came about.
Well, my first book was a collection of short stories called By the North Gate. It's a very long time ago. It's embarrassingly long. It makes me out to be very old. But how can I avoid saying it was 1963? And that was a collection of short stories, as I said. And then my next book was a novel that came along maybe 2 years later. So I've just kept on writing since then. And as I say, I'm very project-oriented.
It strikes me that writing must be one of the toughest jobs in the world. Nobody stands over you. When I come to work here, I have certain deadlines to meet. I have a paycheck that I have to get every week. But a writer, you talk about being project-oriented, but nobody stands over you. Shoulders is Joyce. Have that project ready in 2 weeks.
Well, that's true. I guess it's inner directed. It becomes very fascinating, though. I have a drawer filled with notes and sketches and drafts of things. More than enough for 2 lifetimes. I'll never be able to execute all those ideas. Sometimes I look at them and have a sense of vertigo that all this is in there and I can't deal with it.
But it must take an enormous sense of willpower to compel oneself to work independently.
Well, that's a way of looking at it. I think about it as a kind of riddle. If I want to evoke a certain emotion or a certain mood, I want to memorialize a certain period in American history, let's say, I have to do it by way of language because I'm not a visual artist, I'm not a photographer, I'm not a musician. So I'm doing it in the medium that I work with, which is language. And I have to be equal to the task. And the anxiety arises from feeling that one is not always equal to the task. One of the elements in the novel is the relationship between a young girl and her mother who becomes an alcoholic and descends into alcoholism and finally into death. And this is based on an experience that I had, though not with my mother, in fact with no relative of mine, but with an older woman whom I knew and with whom I was very close, and she died of alcoholism some time ago. And I wanted to write a really honest novel about what it is like to see someone whom you love descend into alcoholism, to try to help the person but fail. I just wanted to be true to that bitterness and just write something that was very honest and not have a happy ending where the mother joins Alcoholics Anonymous, but just be true to that trajectory. Then there are other things that are happening in the novel that not necessarily negative, but I wanted to be true to that one thing. So I was obsessed with that. For years I wanted to write about that because I couldn't comprehend how this beautiful woman, this friend of mine, could become an alcoholic, and she gave up her health and her beauty and she gave up her love of life just for alcohol. And I've always found it like a riddle. So for me, the act of writing didn't require willpower, but it was almost that I was drawn into it. Like I wanted to understand this. I tell my students, my students are really very energetic and gifted, but sometimes they don't know what to write about. They're afraid to write about their real subjects. I tell them to look upon their lives as mysteries and to seek the deepest mystery and something that they want to understand and they can't understand. And go to that and start writing about it. And all sorts of emotions come up. And a lot of strength comes up from the unconscious. So I think that's what happened with me.
You said something a moment ago that alluded to a certain degree of uncertainty when one writes. But you're such a gifted writer, it's hard to imagine you're ever being uncertain.
Oh, I'm always uncertain.
Can I do this? Can I finish this? Can I write this in a way that is believable, understandable?
Oh, I'm always caught up against that. Most mornings of my life are very, very difficult, very arduous, and I feel I'm always failing. I keep at it long enough, though, so I take the failure, say I may have a week's work that's pretty bad. It's not that it's even bad, but it's not good enough. It doesn't have its own integrity somehow. And I just keep on working with it and working with it and working with it till finally I get it up to what I call a level of acceptability. Then I move on to the next chapter. So I work very slowly. It's like building a ladder where you're building your own ladder rung by rung and you're climbing the ladder. It's not the best way to build a ladder, but I don't know any other way.
You said slowly, but you have published some 20 novels, right?
Well, that's true, but I do work slowly. It's just that I get very obsessed about something when I'm working on it, so I keep at it.
Well, I guess if you write almost every day, the pages do pile up.
The pages pile up, and also you reach a plateau. If you have 20 pages that you've been working on for a couple weeks, then you can revise those pages very, very fast. So you spend one day typing it all over, revising it, and you get a real renewal of strength, and you made it better and stronger. It's, as I say, like building the ladder rung by rung. So then you have 21 pages, and then you feel really good, and then you go on to the next chapter. And a couple weeks later, you have 40 pages. And it does add up. I'm very faithful to what I work on. I never abandon it. And I guess I'm just a very loyal person. I stay loyal to writers whom I read. If I read a writer and like the writer, I'm always loyal to that writer, to that poet. I'm just very a faithful, kind of dogged person. So it's the same with my own writing. I have writer friends who just give up on projects, who take 6 months off. But I would never give up on anything.
Tell me about them. You won the National Book Award. That gave you a lot of very favorable publicity when that was announced.
Well, the publicity was certainly inadvertent. I didn't expect to win. I was writing then about the Detroit riots of 1967, which we lived through because we lived there. And that's another example of wanting to understand an experience that had a certain social, cultural significance. I lived in the city of Detroit, and there was looting and burning and rioting about two blocks from where we lived in our house. I was teaching at the University of Detroit at the time. And I was caught up in this maelstrom of social upheaval. And the National Guard was called out and so forth. So I spent the next year or so thinking and writing about what I thought might have been leading up to that experience. But if I hadn't lived in Detroit and hadn't had this fortuitous experience, I would not have written that novel. Definitely would not have.
You would have written another novel.
I would have written another novel, but it wouldn't have been, I'm sure, significant, because it wouldn't have been a quintessential American city. Detroit was sort of an emblematic American city. It had all these qualities. It had a racial mixture. And it was the automotive center. It was the murder city.
It still is.
It still is.
I bet you're glad you're not living there anymore.
Well, it's much more economically depressed now.
Sounds like a grim, grim place to live.
Well, there are many grim places to live. That would not be the worst, probably.
Well, there's Toledo, Ohio, where I used to live.
There's Gary, Indiana. I find these places very interesting, though. I have very warm memories of Detroit because I don't associate happy suburban areas with spiritually rich places. I think of Detroit as a place where a lot was happening, and there were passions, and I knew people there whom I loved very much. It's a very complex period.
Of course, you live in Princeton now, but that's almost an idyllic location, isn't it?
Princeton's very idyllic. Princeton is a kind of improvised or invented place. It somehow doesn't seem like an indigenous place, by which I mean everybody's from somewhere else and may soon be moving on to another place. There are these pockets of culture around the United States associated with, often with institutions of higher learning. Everybody's from somewhere else.
Now, you have an association with the Ontario Review.
Yes, my husband is the editor and publisher, and I assist him, but it's mainly his work.
Tell me about the publication.
The Ontario Review is a biannual literary review, and it's a quite representative American literary magazine publishing fiction and poetry and art. It comes out twice a year. It's a small, what we call a small magazine, like the Paris Review or the Hudson Review.
Do you help in reviewing manuscripts?
I help reading manuscripts, yes.
Do you get a lot of them?
Yes, we get a good deal, though we certainly don't get as many as Antaeus, which is perhaps the leading American literary magazine. We do get a lot, but I help my husband. He does most of the work.
Does he teach as well?
He did teach for 20 years, and he's retired.
Mm-hmm.
He took very, very early retirement.
Now, you're teaching creative writing at Princeton. It would, from what I have, what I understand, writing is a very difficult life, and it's filled with rejection. Do you have any advice along those lines when you convene a class of your students?
My students are undergraduates, and they're taking this as an elective. They may be taking drama, acting, pottery. I mean, they may be taking various things, photography. So it's something that they're taking rather than wanting to have a career. A few of them are gifted enough and maybe strong enough to go on to have a career, but even those students often go into teaching. So it's not like a professional school or an MFA program.
I was talking to Richard Merrick a while back. He, of course, was with Dutton. He said it is so difficult for a writer who would prepare a manuscript and then hand it out to an uncaring world.
Yes.
And here are these students in your class. They're writing manuscripts. You care, of course, because you're their teacher. But you wonder. Sometimes it's hard to get anybody to even read a work of fiction. Fiction is just on a slightly higher level than poetry.
Than poetry. Well, there's quite a quantity of it being done. I think the submissions that we get at the Ontario Review are always read with great interest, and we're always looking for new young writers. I think that people who complain about not being published are perhaps not always publishable. That's the problem, because many works are being published, and first novels are being published. They're not perfect. They're not brilliant novels. They're good novels, and they're worth publishing, but they're not works of genius. I really don't know what the problem is, apart from just the quantity. I think the goodwill is there on the part of publishers, definitely.
How do you go about teaching a creative writing class? Is it like a workshop?
It's a workshop. They're workshops. The students are working on their own projects, and they bring them in, and we photocopy them, and everybody reads a copy, and then we act like editors, I think. The students who are allowed in the seminar or workshop have already been writing, and they apply to our program. There are about 10 people teaching. So they're not people who have never written anything and just take a course thinking that they'll be taught how to write. They're already fairly serious.
I took a couple of semesters of creative writing when I was in college. My teacher was Hollis Summers.
Oh, I know Hollis Summers.
Or
knew him.
He passed away. He died 2 years ago.
Yes.
What I must have inflicted on that poor man. I mean, I'm talking about adolescent writing. But I don't know how people had the time to do it, because we were expected to produce a fairly well-crafted short story every 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also a journalism major, and I worked almost full-time at the local campus radio station as special events director, plus a full array of classwork and the kinds of things that underclassmen do in terms of drinking and this sort of thing.
And sports, probably.
Tennis. You had to take something. I took tennis, but it seems to me that writing is such a commitment that and it's so time-consuming that it's a very difficult thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I can see studying writing if you don't have a lot of other activities.
Yes, yes. I agree. People don't understand how time-consuming it is, how you can sit down at 8 o'clock in the morning and by noon have one paragraph to show for the whole morning. I don't know why it is so slow. But then when you're revising, things go much more swiftly.
Well, you've been writing for many years. Does it get any easier?
No, I think it gets harder. It gets harder because you don't want to do that which you have already done. You don't want to write a novel that you've already written, so you choose a new medium or new technique, a new structure, a new language, new subject, a new angle of vision. So I tend to always be moving on to trying something different, and I try not to use the same structures for novels. Therefore, it does get harder.
Do you see any general changes in American fiction over the years, as, say, fiction was being written in the 1930s?
Well, that's hard to answer, because some fiction written in the 1930s was work of surpassing genius, of a kind of symbolist nature like Faulkner's. But probably most of the writing was fairly workmanlike realism, which has always been with us, at least in the 20th century. So when you have Faulkner writing, you have a genius in your midst, and I'm not sure what that means, whether it characterizes the era or just characterizes that one man. Then in the 1960s, we had a good deal of experimentation in prose fiction, which is very healthy and exciting. Writers like Donald Barthelme and Robert Coover and John Barth and others.
Postmodernist, I think they're called?
They may be called that. I think it's just a term.
Whatever that means.
Whatever it means.
I never know what that means.
Well, postmodernism, I would consider myself in part a postmodernist. It simply means a writer who uses different modes of expression. Like, I use the mode of expression that we call realism sometimes. But I'm not necessarily a realist. The novel, because it is bitter, is completely a realistic novel. It has what I might call metaphorical language, and I use certain devices of style or technique that I would consider symbolist. But basically, it's a realistic novel. That doesn't mean that I'm a realist writer. It means I used that expression, a realism for that novel. Then another novel I might write, I'll use a surrealist technique or vision. That is what is meant by postmodernist, that one chooses different kinds of expression. Well, Shakespeare did that, as a matter of fact. Shakespeare could be very playful and could be writing about a fairy tale world, or he could be very grim and gritty and absolutely realistic in the psychology of human beings and write about blood and tragedy. I think most writers today, whose names you may have heard of, are writing in a postmodernist vein.
Well, I've noticed one area in which writing has changed, and that's the explicitness of both the scenes and language. We don't have to worry today about being censored, and censorship was common in the 1930s and the 1940s. Books
yes.
could be seized by the postal authorities. People could be arrested on pornography or obscenity charges. That doesn't happen today. And as a result, our language is extremely explicit, sometimes shockingly. So I was reading Sue Miller's new novel, I think it's called Family mm-hmm. Pictures.
I haven't read that.
It's a wonderful, beautiful book. And it's extremely well done. And she has a great degree of sexuality in this book. And although she herself says she didn't think it was that explicit, but I thought it was. But it was not gratuitous. I mean, it worked.
Yes.
It was logical. But that sort of writing would never have been permitted 25, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I know. In the case of Joyce's Ulysses, it caused so much trouble, and D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover, those pioneering books of that kind. Well, I think it's just the natural development of a strain of realism that one wants to show the way people really behave and the way they really talk.
But that's the genius of fiction, isn't it? Even more than nonfiction, fiction gets into our hearts and our minds and our souls and tells us the way we really are.
Yes, I think so, and it heightens and selects out and eliminates certain things.
Yes, if you're writing a biography of someone, you can express where the person has gone, where he's going, the people he knew. You may theorize about his motivations, but in fiction you can get right into a person and all of his greed and loneliness and hate and fear can be expressed in a variety of different ways. I was reading a book that Dan Rather wrote many years ago about President Nixon. This book was highly critical of President Nixon. And throughout this book, Rather and his co-writer, I think his a man by the name of Gates, kept saying, then Nixon felt, and then Nixon believed, Nixon thought. And as I read that, I wondered,
how do they know that, really?
I mean, they can assume it based on his actions, maybe.
That's right.
But how could they really? Well, they're not psychiatrists.
I know, and even psychiatrists wouldn't know. It seems like quite a license, doesn't it?
But a fiction writer can do it.
Well, a fiction writer has to do it. That's the whole province of being a fiction writer. I know that that's really an exercise of chutzpah to say that you know what other people are feeling. I would be very hesitant to do that, I must say.
Are you still a reader, or do you think, or does that cut into your own work?
Oh, I read all the time. To me, reading is a great pleasure. It's my reward for working.
Do you find yourself influenced by other people who you you read?
Which
may be kind of awkward for someone who wants to be an original.
It's hard to be influenced.
It is hard?
Oh, yes, I think so. If it were easy to be influenced, writers would simply be reading Thomas Mann, and then they'd write brilliant, dense, intellectual novels. But you can read Thomas Mann. My students could read Thomas Mann, or they could read Dostoevsky or Tolstoy or Flaubert or Hemingway or Faulkner, and it won't make much difference at all. They can be influenced by Hemingway because of the style. Because Hemingway has a style that, at least on the surface, seems imitatable. But it's very hard to be influenced by another writer on a deeper level.
God, I'm influenced. I mean, I say, gosh, I wish I could write like that. Or with Sue Miller's book, I wish I could write like that. And I think as I make my own fumbling attempts to write, I think I am influenced. I do want to try to write like that.
But it wouldn't last long because your own voice would come forward. If you started writing, say you were under the you wanted to write like Hemingway, that might last for 12 days. And then you get bored with that and you'd hear another voice and another rhythm coming, and that would be your true voice. See, we all have true voices. And then that starts coming forward and you just forget about the other. Faulkner found his true voice when he was about 28. He was imitating all sorts of people. You probably know that. He was imitating Sherwood Anderson and Aldous Huxley. He was even imitating T.S. Eliot and Swinburne. Faulkner was imitating other men to get his own voice going, like priming a pump or getting well water up. And finally he got his own Faulknerian voice and he just ran with it and becomes a voice of genius. But we all have our own voices.
I think you're right because, and it's hard to disguise them. It's almost like a fingerprint, isn't it?
It's like a fingerprint. And I think when I read a really powerful work of fiction or poetry, I feel excited. And if I were younger or more naive, I would think that I was going to be influenced by that writer. But I know now that you can't be influenced, except you get influenced in terms of morale. You feel
in terms of what?
Morale. You feel good.
Yeah.
If you read Emily Dickinson, I feel so good. Emily Dickinson is great genius. And I've been reading her for 25 years, and I could pick up her book tomorrow and find all sorts of fresh ideas. But when I write, I wouldn't be influenced by her except in that way. A kind of encouragement, kind of cosmological encouragement.
When you're not writing, are you still writing? By that I mean as you came up the elevator in the CVS building or as you walked down the street or you take the train. Do you continue to work, or do you blot out the things you have to do behind your typewriter?
That really depends on my project. I'm just finishing up a short story at home. It's in its final draft, and when I go back home on Wednesday, I will do some more typing. So and I'll revise and I'll spend one more day on it. So that's at a period where I feel that it has realized its integrity. I don't have to worry about it. If I were right in the middle of a novel, it would be like an arm of mine had been torn off and there was raw flesh and blood seeping out. I would feel very hard to leave it because I wouldn't be confident that I could return and it would still be viable. But now, no, I'm right here. I'm not. My mind is not anywhere else. I'm just thinking about what I'm saying.
Well, Joyce Carol Oates, we're out of time, but I did. I just had one other question. If you could address this, do you have any advice that you could offer, any light that you could shed on the nature of writing for aspiring writers?
For aspiring writers? Well, the main thing is to read with great sympathy and very widely. Just read anything that you like. And wherever your pulse beat quickens, that's good. Just read all the books by a writer. It doesn't matter whether somebody says this is a good writer or a literary writer or a postmodernist or a realist. Just read and read. And also look at the world very carefully and listen very carefully and be very... I think it helps to be quiet and listen to other people. I've been talking a good deal this afternoon, but much of the time I'm just rather quiet and I'm listening to other people to find them very interesting.
Joyce Carol Oates, Because It Is Bitter and Because It Is My Heart's Beautiful Book. Thank you very much.
Thank you.